considerations of concern that these firms relate to. And two, in the last 10, 15 years, there has been once more and again a pretty heated debate in times over the relative merits and importance, deepness of complementarity and uncertainty. And that went along actually with developments of new ideas, of experiments, and it was quite an amazing story in itself. I'll say a bit about that along the way as well. So the question that has been nagging me for quite a while is whether what mechanics is final, and for me, that question is based on the realization that we are still not done with the so-called measurement problem. I had a suspicion, looking back across the history of quantum mechanics, that the move in the Copenhagen interpretation to begin with has led us from one puzzle to another problem. So it has shifted the puzzle of wave-particle duality through the complementarity interpretation eventually to which was the resolution, was regarded as the resolution, shifted that puzzle of wave-particle duality into, well, a lasting, persistent ambivalence between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. And in a way, that does relate to the peaceful but uneasy coexistence of quantum theory and relativity. So that's the broader issue that I'm concerned with, but will not go further into in any depth here. I'm working my way towards that through the material discussed in this talk, but having said all this now, I'll leave that subject and then problematics more or less completely for now. And in having done so, I've turned my abstract upside down. What I said, I would have concluding remarks on I threw a few ideas for debate. So the issues, well, are, I would say as much as that, the issues are that in the ambivalence between quantum and classical mechanics, that on one hand, quantum mechanics is regarded as the new and more comprehensive theory that replaces classical mechanics, invalidates it, or shows up its limits and its limited applicability. It renders the physics an approximation. On the other hand, the formulation of quantum mechanics in its concrete forms, be it non-relativistic or relativistic, always is done on a classical microscopic space-time background. So there is a relic, a remnant of the so-called correspondence principle, and that comes in partly quite nice and elegant mathematical formulations. The one I like best is that due to Wigner and Mackey through systems of covariance and incrementality. For Bohr, well, Bohr was the one who pointed out throughout his quantum career the necessity of the classical language for the description of experiment. So we have quantum mechanics invalidating or restricting quantum mechanics, and on the other hand, essentially depending on it in its interpretation. The quantum measurement problem can be seen as related to that tension between quantum and classical, in that at the classical level we do have an objective description in terms of actual values, whereas quantum mechanics largely typically deals with indeterminate values, as it were. And the measurement problem in a nutshell is the problem of explaining, if possible, within quantum mechanics, how that transition occurs in each and every measurement. That generically we have a situation where values of observables are indeterminate, and nevertheless in the measurement we end up with definite outcomes, despite the linearity of the Schrödinger equation, which should hopefully govern also the evolution of measured object plus measuring device. In that problem, one might argue as well, like all the other problems or issues of quantum mechanics, those of non-separability, non-locality, and well, these are the ones I want to mention here. And I just briefly mention my personal perspective in all this. I have been working on one strand of my research on the issue on issues to do with complementarity uncertainty relations and the development of the theory of POV measures for several decades by now. I stumbled into this having done my first piece of research in general relativity on clocks falling into black holes, thereby correcting a claim that Müller made at the time in the late 1970s, and to the extent that clocks thrown into with high accelerations will eventually, well, they will crack anyway, but will eventually turn up to show infinite times. So what I showed at the time was that classical clocks don't do that. They show a finite passage of time, even if they go into a singularity. When it came to generalizing these considerations to quantum clocks, I quit and thought I need to learn more about quantum mechanics. And well, my supervisor, Professor Mittelstedt Cologne, being himself a student of Heisenberg's, he offered me, among several other options, one which was sort of a leftover from Heisenberg's work on the uncertainty relation. In the 1970s at least, it wasn't at all, still then it wasn't clear at all, whether Heisenberg's interpretation of the uncertainty relation in terms of measurements and simultaneous measurements and measurement inaccuracies was defendable. So my task was to give a measurement theoretic justification of that. And that led me onto the journey that I then went through, the development of POVMs to use in that context, bring that together with concrete experimental models, and thereby give that justification. So I was all into uncertainty relation, whereas my close colleague and friend, whom I just got to know at the time, Pekka Laki, was very much concerned with complementarity, developing or exploring quantum mechanics as a theory of complementarity. So my supervisor, Professor Mittelstedt, at one time went to Laki from the conference and said, well, I have a student who has just disproved what you are doing here. Which was giving a framework of complementarity which says position and momentum are not jointly measurable in one meaning of complementarity. So the two of us got together and became good friends, and we understood each other very well on these matters. So we thought all this was sorted for many years, and then in the 1990s, everything seemed to start over again. So I was beginning to wonder, where does this come from, and that's what I'm going to talk about here. So the ongoing argument is, state is blanking, which one of those is more constant, but more fundamental, deeper, complementarity or indeterminacy? It has been unresolved, as I claim, since the debate between Bohr and Heisenberg on these matters, which, according to all historical reports, had to be regarded as solved since 1927. But nevertheless, I'll show that that is not quite the case. And then there was this vivid debate in the 1990s, which I'll say a bit about. All this, I think, is at the heart of the Copenhagen interpretation, so it would seem better to come clean on it and finally end up with that something that could have been a coherent Copenhagen interpretation. Well, I may ask, if it's a well-posed question to begin with, what do we mean by deep? I don't know. And then, logically, are these principles independent? Well, I do know. I won't tell you now. Well, then, why just these two principles? One could add others. There's the superposition principle of Dirac. EPR and Schrödinger were the ones who brought entanglement into the limelight. They were perhaps not the first to be fully aware of it and its implications, but that is not well explored. Having said all this, I should also come clean on what I mean by a quantum principle. For the purposes of this talk, it's not what one usually ought to understand, but it may be a postulate that is used to deduce features of the theory, or deduce part of a system of postulates that are used to to derive quantum mechanics, as it were, or formulate the basic formulation of the theory on. Rather, I just take these principles here as what they usually are in the textbook literature, features that distinguish quantum mechanics from classical mechanics in an essential way. So here's my plan. I'll be going through a review of new ideas and experiments on complementarity in the context of wave-particle duality. I'll show that this carries with it the old misconceptions leading to new debates. After which I ask about the origins, the roots of that controversy. And having uncovered those, there will be a bit of a little critique, getting this all into perspective in the light of historical roots. And hopefully I'll get to a conclusion with a, as I hope, coherent account of the relationship between these concepts and how they should be understood. All this is part of joint work with Chris Chilleby, my last research student who's still at the University of Hull, from which I moved recently to York. As a warm up, here is complementarity in a nutshell. What I'll do in the next couple of minutes is, or half hour, I'll go through the material in various iterations, making the terms more and more explicit and specific. So here I start with what everybody would refer to, perhaps, if you try to explain quantum mechanics to a layperson. You might be talking about double slit experiments and wave particle duality, and the complementarity that Bohr had in mind was that you have to use both those pictures, wave and particle, although strictly speaking, well, not even strictly speaking, they just contradict each other. And that was a puzzle to be solved in the pre-quantum era. And Bohr, in his discussions with Einstein, or in the report of his discussions with Einstein, paraphrased it with this pair of pictures, which highlights that for him it is essential in the complementarity interpretation that measuring devices are solidly tied to the environment in order for them to be able to function to serve their purpose. So if you want to see interference, you have to do one thing. If you want to follow the path of the photon, electron, whatever, you have to do another thing, namely deal with part of the apparatus dynamically, and that requires a different setup, which is not to be used simultaneously, impossible to use simultaneously with the previous setup. So that is at least one aspect of complementarity.
Can you just say a bit more about what the second device is
supposed to do? This front bit, the front slit, and the idea comes from Einstein, actually. Why don't we try to track the particle by seeing, by measuring the deflection that it takes in the first slit? We'll kick the first slit when it passes through, and by measuring the recoil on the slit, we might be able, well, we will be able, classically at least, to deduce which way the particle went. And then Bohr comes and argues, actually referring, making use of the uncertainty relation in a fairly informal way, argues that using the uncertainty relation, one can actually show that this isn't working.
So, meaning the particle doesn't go through the slit there, but it actually hits the parking hits.
Well, some of it's the idea that it will have, that in order to get through it, it nevertheless have to interact with the slit, which is apparent through the diffraction of the wave packet, as it were. It's a very loose way of reasoning, and not formalized at all. So here are a set of ideas that then are connected for probably in everybody's mind as the first idea to do with complementarity. It's to do with wave-particle duality. Many people take it as similar to that. It's to do with mutual exclusion of either having path knowledge or interference patterns in an interferometer. It's to do with the mutual exclusion of experiments. And finally, it's relevant, or it indicates a limitation of the application of classical physical concepts. That's an important point in Bohr's reasoning. Well, coming to uncertainty, my favorite cartoon still is this one. The indeterminacy of the path that the guy took. You might have think in terms of a story that goes with it, the other guy must have missed to look at it when it happened, but then saw it happen with the traces. And then one wonders, is the guy rushing off is still able to produce interference in whichever way. Never mind. This is one illustration of uncertainty of paths. In a way that was brought to the public by the New Yorker in 1940, I think it was. Well, uncertainty is characterized typically by the formulation of the uncertainty relation in terms of variance for pairs of observables. And again, it serves as an illustration of the limitation of classical concepts in quantum mechanics, that is. Now, let's get a bit more serious and give some preliminary definitions to get some working definition here. Complementarity. This is taken from Scully, England, and Walter. That is the highly influential review paper of 1991, given Nature then, and has since then continued to pile up citations about 13 years. So if it keeps inspiring people or provoking people, whichever way you take it. So their definition is given up there. We say that two observables are complementary. If science knowledge of one of them implies that all possible outcomes of measuring the other one are equally probable. Well, does that have to do with our previous ideas? I don't need to make that clear. The principle of complementarity according to these authors is that for each degree of freedom, the dynamical variables are paired complementary observables. Less precise version in practical terms is, no matter how the system is prepared, is all that the measurement whose outcome is utterly unpredictable. Note that this effectively uses the concept of uncertainty. Uncertainty relation, we all know these formulas, don't we? The uncertainty principle has various formulations, non-controversial ones and controversial ones. The non-controversial ones is a spelling out as this mathematical relation as a statistical specialization for two separate sets of measurements. Nothing wrong with that, and that is a safe option if you want to be sure to say nothing wrong. But it's also not as pictorial as the others, which deal with knowledge, simultaneous knowledge or measurements of values of observables and their indeterminacy. And the one that has been most controversial is the one that refers to measurements. I would say simply because at the time of Heisenberg, when he formulated it, and for decades later, there was no notion of simultaneous measurement of complementary observables. There was no notion of unsharp measurements to begin with. Some typical assessments of the situation. Complementarity distinguishes the world of quantum phenomena from the realm of classical physics. This is Tully, England, and Walter. England actually is the editor of Julian Schwinger's quantum mechanics text. And Julian Schwinger was an advocate of complementarity as the decisive principle of quantum mechanics on which to base formulation in terms of considerations of measurement efficiencies. And a good part of that is reflected in his book, indeed. So, in that book, you find complementarity highlighted and the uncertainty principle downgraded to the uncertainty relation. Likewise, with Asher Peres, he has his own nice way of doing this. He states the principle of complementarity, but almost ignores uncertainty principle, although not the uncertainty relation. So, how does he almost ignore the uncertainty principle? Well, highlight this one. This is page 445, where you find, if you look for it, the uncertainty principle, and it refers you to page 445. That's all he has to say about it. That's Asher. Richard Feynman, conversely, what does he do? He refers, as we all know, to the interference experiment as the one that in reality contains the only mystery. His analysis of it does not well mention Bohr or complementarity. It's all in terms of uncertainty principle. Leslie Ballantyne, likewise, in a more recent textbook. And that led us onto a survey of textbooks. We did a good dozen or so across the history. And what we find is there are these two opposing camps. One carefully avoiding reference or playing down the uncertainty principle, focusing on complementarity. The other camp, well, being fond of the uncertainty principle and completely ignoring complementarity in reference to that. So there are two, as it were, perhaps complementary accounts of the same story, namely the wave part of the duality experiments.
Are the difference in attitude, are they documented or are they pointed out or are they just, you know?
Well, it's an inference that we take. What we sensed was a degree of uneasiness with either one or the other. Although the earlier authors, Englert, come in as well, they have, in some way, Englert in particular, had some rather dogmatic, very emphatic comments about it. Well, we'll see some of this. So, well, there is a neutral party as well, namely those who reiterate the story that then was told by Pauli, sort of as a compromise, a unification of the two viewpoints. So, Bohr and Heisenberg had hard arguments about it to the point that Bohr needed a holiday. Both needed to recover, and it took Pauli and others, Kramers I think is also mentioned in that connection, to bring them back together and help them to realize that really they meant the same thing. So that is how the official story goes. Well, how much less true, I'll show you shortly. Now on to the experiments that one would like to consider. There is the one that I referred to, proposed by Einstein and rejected by Bohr, with the recoiling diaphragm. This is given a quantum mechanical treatment. It's a paper of Woodless and Zurich in 1979. But the story is still that according to which the uncertainty relation can be used to enforce complementarity, to enforce the destruction of interference as soon as you look for the path of the particle. So this is the traditional scheme. Here's another one that you know, Feynman's, where he uses light where the electron went, which hole it went through, and then he refers to the uncertainty principle in a very loose way, again, to argue that the interference is wiped out. Now, here's a new scheme, that is the one proposed by Scully, Englert, and Walter, and that really provided inspiration to get the experimental field going on this. And they proposed path marking by entanglement of the space degrees of freedom with the eternal states of the atom. Or rather, no, that's wrong. I'm going ahead of myself. That's the other experiment that comes in a moment. This is building up entanglement with the cavity field, as a matter of fact, here. And the argument goes that this cannot be explained in terms of mechanical kicks imparted on the atoms. The partial wave functions go, spatial wave functions go through, essentially unaltered through the interaction with the light field, microwave field rather, and yet one sees the destruction of the interference as soon as that path marking process is complete. Here's the mathematical description of this process. We have a superposition of two path states, and then we get this entangled state, and as we all know, then the path probability distribution has no interference terms left. They went on to a modification of this experiment, the details that I haven't included here. But it's an experimental setup with a different measurement method on the photon field. Instead of observables with eigenstates phi plus minus, they measure observables with eigenstates phi 1, 2. They now go on to measure eigenstates phi plus and minus. And in this way, they are able to restore interference patterns. which goes to show that the path has remained indeterminate. It had been potentially detectable through the correlations, but hasn't been really made a definite quantity. It can be undone. This is very much, has been discussed very much in line with the EPR situation, in fact. You can see why. So, novel features here are the neutralization of entanglement. There's no change of the confirmed wave functions. And there's the possibility of erasure of the path information that appears to have been gained. The controversial claims are that there is no significant momentum transfer, and that therefore the uncertainty relation is not needed to enforce complementarity. Now you have to look at that paper. It's really a very beautifully written paper, but these passages are just unsatisfactory. They give a definition of complementarity in terms of the theta that I gave you, which I would refer to as value complementarity. If you know one observable exactly, then you know nothing about the other. And in no place do they use that concept in the later arguments. Then they conclude, well, there are no peaks here on the atoms. Therefore, the uncertainty relation cannot be relevant to enforce complementarity here. So that is ruled out as an obstacle. There's no indication of how the uncertainty relation should come into play. It's just reference to this old-established pretended fact, alleged fact, that the uncertainty relation goes one-to-one with classical kicks. And, well, the experiment does show that that interpretation is also ruled out. But that is what is ruled out, this connection between uncertainty relation and classical kicks. That is what they actually rule out, that they think they have sort of remove the uncertainty relation as an obstacle. And that is what they say in the text prose that I have here, that sort of reference to the traditional way. And we've discussed this, and then they go on to what they have done. They found a way around this position momentum obstacle, found a way based on matter-related discovery, to obtain which part of particle-like information without scattering, or otherwise introducing that in phase factors. So then they refer to correlations that are relevant. In this sense, they concede the way to be detected which does not fall prey to the uncertainty, to the position momentum of certain duration. So that's how emphatic they are about this. Then there was a rather, well, not quick reaction, but based on, well, it entered Nature 3 years later, based on work published elsewhere in between, that was carefully analyzed by Story, Tan, Collett, Walls. They give arguments whereby they insist that the principle of complementarity is the consequence of Heisenberg uncertainty relation. Rebuttal, we disagree. The principle of complementarity is much deeper than the uncertainty relation, although it's strictly enforced by it.
Excuse me, can you go back? I didn't manage to read all that.
Well, don't. Somebody, you can do that later. You can do that if you want to. By the way, the blue highlightings are mine, not the author's. Just to be clear about that. So, both parties here criticize each other of misunderstandings, and then the reconciliation comes from a proposed one, at least, from Wiseman and Harrison. What do they say? Boyd used a simple picture of uncontrolled classical momentum kicks to show how the uncertainty principle enforced complementarity is valuable, show that this naive realist interpretation of the uncertainty relation does not work in general. There is room for Scully et al. To claim that complementarity is more fundamental than the uncertainty principle, but there's also room for claims by Story et al. That one can always consider complementarity as being enforced by the uncertainty principle, if instead the latter is interpreted in terms of the more subtle idea of momentum kick amplitudes. So there's a move from classical kicks over to quantum mechanical ways of transferring momentum, which in specific examples is analyzed and explained in detail by these authors, not in this paper, but in related publications. And they see that as sort of a compromised way out, doing justice to both parties. And then it was quiet until 1998, where an experimental realization comes about by Dillon Remp, I think at the time they were in Constance. Let's focus on the new parts. Interesting. We find that the classical momentum kicks are much too small to wash out the interference pattern. Instead, correlations destroy the interference fringes. We show that the back action onto the atomic momentum implied by Heisenberg's position momentum upset relation cannot explain the loss of interference. So they treat these things nice, cleanly, separately. Classical kicks, they give an argument that doesn't do it. Then they look at the Heisenberg uncertainty relation and they give an argument that doesn't do it. And then they give leave it as an open question whether the concept of quantum momentum transfer can be generalized to schemes without a mechanical double slit. So this shows a good level of clarity about the problems at stake. And here is how they do that. They use standing light and microwave fields to produce a splitting and path marking. Let me just brush over that quickly here. That shows how the frequencies in these microwave or light fields are connected with the internal degrees of freedom. And what matters is that in the end, you have a correlation between the different possible paths and two distinct authorities in terms of states. So the same entanglement arising as in the proposal of Scully and Walter. And then the debate started all over again into a second phase, and I just give you some samples of what happened. Björk et al. Had a series of papers dealing with these matters, and they insist or actually show quite nicely that complementarity and uncertainty relation are intimately connected in those contexts, in those settings. So they refute Engler's claim that there is no uncertainty relation that would give rise to the breakdown of interference in those experiments, but the articles show that indeed one can find a suitable uncertainty relation. It's not the one between position and momentum anymore, it's something more subtle than that. Then, on the other hand, Lewis again, and many others actually, give examples where the standard position momentum uncertainty relation plays no role. So the debate still suffers from lack of distinction of what one actually should be talking about here.
But there are, so what is this new subtle uncertainty relation like? I mean, after the waiting loops involved?
Sorry?
This new uncertainty relation that you
variables involved? That belongs, to show that belongs to the technical part that I don't have yet. There's a bit more coming later if I get to it. It's to do with a move from the discussion of the continuous case of two-state experiments over to a description, well, like Mach-Zehnder interferometry, where you can deal with two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. And then it's just a not too difficult mathematical consideration to show that your complementarity relation goes indeed one to one with a payoff relation that you can interpret as a transcript relation. Mm-hmm. I think unfortunately I didn't provide the details of that yet.
Isn't it possible that there's some kind of decoherence occurring in the experiment? There's an environmental effect destroys the coherence. How do you know that's not true?
I don't know. I hope the experiment doesn't know that that is not relevant.
They say, well,
they say they can recreate it.
Well, they can recreate it. Indeed, that is a good argument. They actually also do, I think, there are other implementations of erasure, which shows that nothing gets lost into the environment. And you can restore to a very good degree the interference pattern by measuring another set of observables on these internal degrees of freedom or onto the photon field in these two experiments, also their experiments.
So there's no interference with the experimental.
Yeah, so I think it's fair or safe to say that there's nothing. Yeah.
The idea is good out here. If that's not true, there's no reason to go on with this. Because you're saying it's worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Ah. Gets as dramatic as this year. Kim and Marlon wrote a paper with the title "Uncertainty Rescue: Bohr's Complementarity for Composite Systems." And they use an uncertainty relation that involves covariance terms for a compound system. So there's uncertainty relations as a way of representing aspects of entanglement, as it were. Well, that brings me to second part of discussion. I'll do that very briefly, hopefully. The issues that emerge in this debate and in this development are the old ones, namely the question of the relationship, on one hand, to get this clear, of complementarity and wave particle duality. One can ask the question whether that concept of, that definition of complementarity given by Scaliger and Walter is actually relevant to the discussion of the wave particle duality experiment. I don't want to go into that. Short answer is yes, it's suitable for that purpose. The other question that came up here is that between, well, the central one for my talk, the relation between complementarity and uncertainty, and finally, the question about the mechanisms that enforce complementarity in the context of wave particle duality means a question about mechanisms enforcing the destruction of interference, given that one acquires the possibility of knowing the path. Well, that's the issues, and well, I would need to say something, I would like to say something more about the roots of the controversy. And then some quickly. So the issues are identified. I don't want to say more about it before I reach the critique part. So on to the rules. And what's to be observed there is that in the early stages of the completion of quantum mechanics in 1996, 1997, 1998, Bohr, Heisenberg, and Pauli, it must be said, exerted quite a great deal of flexibility in the use of the terms. There are some reflections on this. You may read these for yourselves. Einstein never understood complementarity, as he admits freely in 1949, in his 70th birthday volume by Schill. Heisenberg in 76 makes this ominous remark that perhaps one shouldn't strive to be too precise. It's not in the spirit of the limitations of language that were at the center of the discussions between him and Bohr at the time in their attempts to understand the implications of the new quantum mechanics. And there is the story about von Weizsäcker, who on the occasion of Bohr's 70th birthday went back to reread Bohr's original papers, the famous Como lecture, and tried once more to make sense of all that, which is exactly what I have done in these last weeks, with that and several other old papers. Having refrained from touching them for many years, 10, 15 years now, I read them at the time as a student until I thought now I have to get on with some work of my own. And it was very interesting to get back to it now. And that was the feeling, obviously, that von Weizsäcker had. And if you read the account, at least, of Max Jammer, well, I have to say, it compares very much with the account that I would now give of Bohr if I were to do it in my own words. And yet, Bohr was completely unhappy with that. So there's a sense that nobody can dare to claim he is understood what he or she is understood what Bohr really was saying when he spoke about the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. So there has a great deal of Bohr scholarship in across the history of quantum mechanics, and very intense in the 1980s, and apparently it led to some people being somewhat fed up with it, and so this turned in some cases into what has been called Bohr bashing. Well, I have to speed up, I realize. So, Bohr's complementarity interpretation, I have some quotes here, which I probably won't have time to read in all detail. Let's just focus on the blue parts. These are, well, condensed formulations of complementarities that defined in the 1928 paper, Nature. It's complementarity between space-time description and causal description, between wave picture and particle picture, between wave mechanics and particle mechanics, the definition of energy momentum in terms of plane waves on one hand, and the definition of space-time localization in terms of wave packets on the other hand. And finally, this is not explicit, but fairly implicit in the 1938 paper, but explicit in the Bohr reply to Einstein, Lebesgue, and Rosen, the complementarity of position and momentum that goes with the mutual exclusion of experimental setups. Should be said, for Bohr, complementarity has two things in it, namely mutual exclusion on those contradictory features, the existence of contradictory modes of description, which nevertheless need to be applied both to get a comprehensive account of the phenomena. Well, the origin for Bohr of this feature of complementarity lies in the quantum postulate. And that is paraphrased as the discontinuity or individuality of quantum phenomena has the implication that in observations one has to face a non-negligible interaction and state change, which became known perhaps as Heisenberg effect and the question mark state reduction. I'm inclined to argue that this is sort of the beginnings of grasping the concept of non-separability comes close to that if one reads some phrases of Bohr's. Further features for Bohr are the emphasis on phenomenon, and that involves the inseparability of object and measuring instrument, and as Jammer explains in great detail in respect of the 1935 paper of Bohr, there is the emphasis on the aspect that the quantum state is a relational concept indeed. I think I have to cut the passages here. They have to do with this relational aspect. That's not central to this here. I have to cut this out, I'm afraid. Bohr's program, well, that's what I referred to when doing this phrase. Indeed, in the description of atomic phenomena, quantum postulate presents the task of developing a complementarity theory, the consistency of which can be judged only by weighing the possibilities of definition and observation. And then in the very last sentences of the 1928 paper, Bohr addresses the issue of reconciling, well, finding a relativistic formulation of quantum mechanics, reconciling quantum mechanics with relativity, and I think that is a very far-sighted observation that he makes there. So perhaps you want to read that in view of my introductory remarks. Formulation of the relativity argument implies essentially the union of the space-time coordination and the demand of causality characterizing the classical theories. Any adaptation of the relativity requirement for the quantum postulate must therefore be prepared to meet with a renunciation as the visualization in the ordinary sense, going still further than in the formulation of the quantum laws considered here. The first Einstein, who was on that path, and then the fact that all these problems come from the fact that every word in the language refers to our ordinary perceptions. In quantum theory, immediate difficulty is one to the question of the inevitability of the features of irrationality characterizing the quantum postulate. I hope, however, that the idea of complementarity is suited to characterize the situation, which bears a deep going analogy to the general difficulty in the form of creation of human ideas inherent in the distinction between subject and object. So, that is the importance that Bohr sees in complementarity. It's the central concept for him, apparently, and it has remained so. Well, if you find Bohr obscure, remember his victim that the complementarity of clarity and truth. He doesn't do it after truth. Well, it has to be said that this program was an inspiration to part of the research community, and that is where I'm coming from. There is this stream of literature that highlights complementarity. And there is some very serious work by Ludwig over several decades, who saw himself as fulfilling this program for. Although I talked to him a couple of months ago over the phone and asked him specifically this, and he was more cautious about it whether that was really what he had achieved. Lastly, in the 1980s, then I mentioned Schwinger. Now, let's turn to Heisenberg and the uncertainty interpretation. There was a sense of desperation even in 1926, which is expressed by Pauli in a letter to Heisenberg. Famous quote about the PI and the QI, if you open the note, then you get crazy. That was the situation before Heisenberg's paper, and then comes Heisenberg's paper, and Pauli says, according to Heisenberg, to put it that this is the talk in the quantum mechanics. It's dawning in quantum mechanics. Heisenberg's central idea was to turn the question around of trying to explain how quantum mechanics can deal with these particle trajectories that we see in cloud chambers, into saying, well, no, it's not quantum mechanics' task to explain how this comes about, but rather quantum mechanics is going to tell us how it's possible that these approximate tracks are there, or in which way it's possible to see tracks. So there's tracks as opposed to trajectories. There are no trajectories according to quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics tells us they are not there, but what is there are approximate trajectories. And that led him then into that formulation of the uncertainty relation. He starts by deriving the uncertainty relation for preparations as a consequence of the formalism, and goes on to look at experimental situations, where then it's readily interpreted in terms of measurement inaccuracies, simultaneous measurements. Or rather, if you look closely, it's the mutual disturbance of position measurements and momentum measurements done in sequence, and then tried to combine, to be combined into a joint. So this is all very tentative as far as the analysis goes. I have to skip that one. Heisenberg's program, again, let's not bother reading it all, is the idea that quantum mechanics should be deduced out of the uncertainty relation. He basically says that in the text. So that's his program as opposed to Bohr's program. There are these two programs, and different sets of people with different backgrounds and mathematical skills perhaps set out to realize one or the other. So that is how it actually went, came about. Then in terms of further interpretation aspects, quantum mechanics is described by Heisenberg later on as the mathematics of the possible, not actual. And it seems to me that you can read out of this consideration at that time something like alignment induced through the selection through interaction of the apparatus with the cluster environment, with a cluster environment. But the point I want to emphasize here for Heisenberg, he went off far away from Bohr, who entertained this relational concept of quantum states and the contextuality with the whole setup, whereas Heisenberg allows at least tentatively for a description of the potentialities of the quantum object. So that's more of a realistic approach to the quantum system, it seems. Well, what do they have to say about each other's concepts? Well, for Heisenberg, complementarity is a possible, is a concept you can use, but he sees, for instance, particle picture, the side function, and wave picture, the quantized field, as equivalent alternative options to describe n particle systems. Alternatives, where Bohr would say, you need them both and they contradict each other. There's a very significant difference in spirit and logic. Yet he accepts the view that the uncertainty relation is an expression of complementarity of position and momentum. So they play with the vagueness of expression, complementarity interpreted at different levels, and that allows them to get on with each other, it seems. But they haven't made it easy for us that way, I guess. Bohr uncertainty, well, this is completely subordinate to the complementarity interpretation. Expression, the uncertainty is expression of the limitations of possibilities of definition and measurement, of the application of physical concepts, the confirmation of the consistency of the quantum formalism with the description of experience, or the expression of the inevitable state changes due to measurement. So that is what it's what the uncertainty relation is good for Bohr. Pauli as a mediator in his famous summary of quantum mechanics, the principle of quantum mechanics, he refers to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Bohr's fundamental discussions thereon. So if we continue reading, well, wave particle duality is referred to, renunciation of objective description at the atomic level, and all this reference to Bohr. But then he goes on to make it explicit, and complementarity is expressed as the complementarity of position and momentum. And that is where we are today most of the time. We take just complementary pairs of observables, complementarity as a relation between observables, rather than descriptions. So he sort of shaped the modern perspective on it. And yet he is guilty of having induced a rather dubious compromise. And there we are with three approaches. So, quickly, some critique. I think I started late, so I will not finish early. The issues were complementarity versus, in relation to wave particle duality, study and advantage used by complementarity. And all I want to say here is, yes, one can show that works. My main concern is complementarity versus uncertainty. The short answer here is position momentum uncertainty relation is not sufficient to enforce strict complementarity in two-suit experiments. This has been shown by Wouters and Zurek in their quantum mechanical model already in 1979, and by Hildebrand and Buffing, who give a positive alternative formulation of what they call an uncertainty relation, which is not anymore in terms of measures of overall width, but they make the point that what matters in interference is in fact the fine structure of one of the wave functions, either the wave function or the momentum distribution. And there are relations that then allow you to argue Bohr's case against Einstein, that the interference pattern gets wiped out. So there's a long story behind that, which is long established. What happened in the discussion in the 1990s was a shift of meaning from strict complementarity and either-or, strict mutual exclusivity of experimental situations, into graded complementarity, or what they called then in the literature, England, etc., called quantitative complementarity. And again, this was developed quite neatly in the 1980s, explored experimentally already at that time, that there is the possibility of getting simultaneous but partial path to the theory of information. There are trade relations, so that I can't go into any of that here, I'm afraid, so let me just rush ahead. What about mechanisms enforcing complementarity? Well, I think the Kick's interpretation has been ruled out long before the debate started in the 1990s. There's work of, for instance, Harvey Brown and Michael Redhead in the 1970s. Who, in my view, sorted that one out. And I wonder whether there really is a versus between entanglement and uncertainty. As I mentioned, some people have shown that there are uncertainty relations that also capture the relevant aspect of entanglement. So one should get rid of these traditional conflations, uncertainty as identical to classical momentum kicks, and be careful with the novel alternative that uncertainty still is tied to quantum momentum transfer. What this shows, this discussion, is that there seems to be still a need for some mechanistic or causal explanation of the uncertainty relation. So the physical mechanisms studied by Anderson and Bohr were via momentum transfer explicitly as a measurement method, and now we are looking at entanglement. So what about these questions, complementarity being more fundamental than uncertainty? Well, I haven't shown you any detailed argument, and I guess they will be coming. I cut out the polemics. Yeah, here's what I said already from Redhead. Here's about Uffing. Didn't see that very briefly. I think I've said most of this, and I can't go into all the details. I don't want to keep you unduly here. one last point that I need to make is there's another shift from the discussion of erasure to what people then call quantitative erasure. And if you look at the erasure setup, you couple your system that goes through a two-state arrangement, let's say, you couple that with another system, maybe internal degrees of freedom. That gives you two possibilities of measurement. You can measure your original system, your past degrees of freedom, or you can measure these internal degrees of freedom. In my perception of things, my working habits compel me to see this as an opportunity to explore joint measurements of the observables of the original system. And that's my interpretation of quantitative erasure, although no mention of that is there, but it's exactly this what's happening in this experiment. We have shown this in one model. Maybe I jump to that and conclude with this. Here are some pictures that you know may know well in different contexts. This is one example from the 1980s and 90s of jointly measuring interference patterns and through a co-medium get partial path interference, path information, and you can see in the experiments that the interference gets degraded somewhat and gets degraded more if your path path measurement is made more precise. So that is graded or quantitative complementarity for you. Perhaps this one as a formal illustration. If you go to qubit observables or Mach-Zehnder observables, take two effects of the form given above in the usual Pauli representation. I've shown long ago that joint measurability is geometrically given by the relation. Can I show here now? But this relation up here, half a plus b plus a half a minus b is equal to 1. If a and b are perpendicular, you're looking at complementary pairs of observables, and this relation turns into this simple Pythagorean relation. And you can interpret that in terms of measurement inaccuracies. So you see that in this setting, two complementary quantities, path interference, are jointly measurable exactly if you allow for sufficient degrees of measurement imprecision in the observables. The effects are sufficiently smeared out effects. So that's one way of making this aspect precise. So here's my coherent account in a nutshell. Uncertainty, but we have to distinguish uncertainty. The concept of uncertainty appears in preparations and in measurements. Latitude and definition of values of observables, the precision in individual measurement outcomes. The uncertainty principle for preparations would say that in any quantum state, the values of most observables are indeterminate. Especially when the observable as an operator doesn't commute with the state as an operator. For measurements, pairs of non-commuting observables can be measured jointly, but only if the measurement implicitly are not too small. The uncertainty relation as a manifestation of the uncertainty principle is then, well, I would say any relation that is gives a trade-off between measures of indeterminacy of imprecision for pairs of non-commuting observables should be called an uncertainty relation. So I would give that latitude to that concept. And that is then how people have made that connection that for complementarity relations in the wave partner values experiments, you can always come up with some uncertainty relation of sorts. Complementary pairs of observables, that's related to setups for preparations or measurements of definite values of the two observables, which are then mutually exclusive if the two observables are not commuting, that is. The preparation version says that if the value of one observable is definite, the other observable is completely uncertain, and vice versa. Measurement version, non-commuting observables cannot be measured together. So these are negative statements. Complementarity principle says there are complementary pairs of observables in that sense. So this is, I would suggest, perhaps the safest way of phrasing complementarity as a strict exclusivity relation. then it's more like a negative statement compared to the uncertainty domain, which gives you a positive possibility of measuring together while respecting complementarity. So here a bit about logical relations, and let me remind you maybe last one. Complementarity is based on the notion of uncertainty. As you remember for study England Malta, if you know the value of one observable, the other one in the pair is completely uncertain, has uniform probability distribution. So the notion of uncertainty is certainly needed in them. Complementarity as such highlights the algebraic aspect, the existence of non-commuting observables, due to the linear structure of the first quantum mechanics. Uncertainty is based on the existence of superpositions of eigenstates. In a superposition of eigenstates of an observable, that observable is known to have indefinite values. It highlights the operational aspect, and here I would refer to what is known as the economical classical embedding of quantum mechanics. That's the question: if you try to find a really good embedding of all the structures of quantum mechanics, states and observables, states and effects, into quantum mechanics, there's, to my knowledge, just one such embedding that is really nice and accurate in every respect. And I've shown in a semi-rigorous way that is actually the only one possible. And in that representation, what comes out is that every quantum effect, whether it's a sharp one or a projection or not, is represented classically by a fuzzy effect, by an unsharp observable. That is a strong indication of, that point of view that quantum mechanics can be, from the classical perspective, can be seen as well as a theory of uncertainty or unsharpness in that sense. Strict complementarity expresses a limitation, strict exclusion of simultaneous application of possible measurements of operations. The uncertainty principle expresses a reconciliation of these mutually exclusive possibilities with a trade-off as price to be paid, a trade-off for the uncertainties or implicities. Complementarity and uncertainty meet in the concept of graded or quantitative polarity and quantitative erasure in just that way. So that's my account of it. I haven't said much about entanglement, but one should bear in mind that entanglement is an instance of superposition of pairwise orthogonal product states, hence an instance of uncertainty at least, although I wouldn't want to subsume it under that altogether. There's certainly much more to be said about it. So in quantum mechanics, the notions and principles of uncertainty, complementarity, entanglement, and superposition are not completely independent, nor do they stand in any simple logical relation. In order to analyze the logical relation between complementarity and uncertainty, what you have to do is actually find a more general framework than quantum mechanics, in which then you can formulate these ideas as postulates, and then you can decide whether they are logically dependent or not. And this work has been done for one by my friend Nicolas, like me. And he showed that in certain realizations of that program, it can indeed show these principles to be independent. You can implement one and there is no trace of the other. So to conclude, really, both the complementarity principle and uncertainty principle have their independent and separate virtues in highlighting characteristics of quantum mechanics aspects of quantum. Rather trivial conclusion, but that is life.
Just historically comment about a question about Einstein. You mentioned just one code for Einstein. Do you have anything further to say later on or earlier?
On complementarity, I'm not aware. I think they didn't, Einstein didn't get stuck on a particular term, really.
From that quote, it appeared that he favored, disfavored complementarity, so it wasn't clear that he favored.
I would say he couldn't really maintain to not favor it because he couldn't make up his mind on it. Not being able to understand it. I think Einstein was a very sincere person. He would say what he thinks. I don't think that was a polemical statement.
So, the notion of complementarity these days sometimes goes by the name of mutually unbiased bases, the way that Scully, Engler, and Walter define it. And in the context of emotional degree of freedom, it turns out that the bases corresponding to any quadrature are mutually unbiased with one another. So not just the position eigenstates and the mental eigenstates, the position eigenstates and the eigenstates of some quadrature that's off from a position by some small angle are also mutually unbiased. So if you had a relation describing a trade-off between certainties about those sorts of measurements, you'd expect it to not pick out a position and momentum. So I wonder whether these generalized sorts of uncertainty relations respect that fact that the standard product of variances will be different if I look at position and some quadrature, not momentum. And you'd expect that if it was some sort of quantitative capturing complementarity that I'd be able to do that for any two quadratures, then I'd get the same sort of uncertainty relation.
Well, the relations that have been proposed in the literature all refer to the discrete case, to the many normal space case, so that I'm completely away from the position you mentioned debate and turn it into that Marxian type context. Where you can basically do the same thing with your rotated spin bases, if you like. I should have brought in the formula, and then you could talk more freely about this. And then we could see what you want to know translates into that case as well. But I suspect that's. I showed you only the formal relation for the case of what England would refer to as quantitative erasure and what I would describe as a joint measurement. There is, of course, a direct uncertainty relation, operational uncertainty relation in terms of the, well, which characterizes parameters of the positive operators. That is usually superseded by aspects that come in from specific states that they're considering. So if you look at experimental relations, then you'll see those two components. You see contribution coming from the measurement setup as well as from the preparation. And I think the focus in the literature is much more, as a rule, on that aspect, the contributions coming from the state. That was a curious development in 1996 when England made an interesting contribution to, he discovered independently and in greater generality the duality relations that I skipped over. You have a measure of path knowledge and a measure of visibility, and you get an additive relation. You square the two and add them up, and you get something that's equal to one. That was known by Monnier from 1995 and 1994. But came into the light really through Engler's paper. And in that paper, Engler tries to make a formal argument showing that this relation actually can be deduced from a single operator, which is, I don't know if it's unity, but certainly it's not self-adjoint. It's not an emission operator. And he makes that his point. Therefore, it is not a relation involving two observables. And sure enough, Björkhoff came and showed that these two measures are actually related to, and I think that's in the direction of answering your question, they are related to variances for pairs of complementary observables. So you can still come out here with an uncertainty relation being responsible for this function. But here it's not a continuous matter. the more path knowledge you acquire or ensure in your setup, the less interference you will see, and vice versa. So this is not really a continuous trade-off between the two. And these relations also show why Bohr's argument against Einstein couldn't get a through, because the uncertainty relations will be valid all the time in whatever setup you have, but nevertheless, you not immediately see the interference pattern disappear. It's quite amazing that these things haven't become clear. Even a couple of years, last year, I think, in a New Scientist in England, in this popular journal, there was a report by on an experiment done at Harvard where someone claimed to have beaten Bohr to it and shown path determination whilst maintaining the interference. So these guys are I think that was a guy that day. These people are still not aware that of this possibility of the interpolation continues between the options. So this is quite interesting.
Make a rather general comment. It's surprising that after over 65 years, we're still debating these issues, even though there's no, listen, misunderstood what you're saying about experiments, there's no known experiment that predicts quantum mechanics. So, why do we debate this? I'm getting at, there's no experiment that we know of that takes basically any combination of the following conceptions. Unless I misunderstood what you were saying, you seem to say there was a destruction of the interference pattern in the experiment, which could not be explained by the uncertainty principle.
Yes.
Are you suggesting there's a contradiction of one of the basic principles?
No. One has to be careful. With these particular experiments, it is the particular uncertainty relation between position and momentum that is apparently not doing the job.
Apparently not doing the job.
Yeah.
This implies substitution.
Well,
with one of its image of quantum mechanics.
The answers that have been given to that, unfortunately, have all been given after the attention shifted to the discrete case, the two-dimensional setup, which you used to describe Marx's interferometers. So you only have two possible paths and a two-dimensional Hilbert space to describe that. In that context, to my knowledge, every proposal of marking the path by entangling especially with something else, every such attempt has been accompanied eventually with a version of an uncertainty relating for a certain pair of complementary observables which accounts for the destruction of the interference. So in that sense, we're coming home again to what everybody believes to be true. We can use uncertainty relations to show how the destruction of interference comes about. In the continuous case, the relevant work is that of Hilgefort and Uffing. They really show explicitly that the normal measure in terms of standard deviations is simply not good enough to run Bohr's argument to begin with. So in that sense, this was just a conceptual blunder from the outset. The arguments given were always very informal, and not too carefully worked out mathematically, but that's exactly what Hilgefort and Uffing did in the early 1980s. They come out with that measure of the width of fine structure features and relate that to, for let's say the momentum pattern, they relate that measure to the overall width of the position amplitude. And that enables them to carry through Bohr's argument properly. So they are saying Bohr should have used that sort of measure of uncertainty, and then everything is fine.
So you're saying that there's no sharp, definite experiment that tells us we have to argue about the one versus the other, complementary principle versus that simple principle. No, physics is basically experimental. Yeah. 65 years later, we're arguing about one versus the other. There seems to be there's no experimental reason for doing that.
Yeah, I would agree.
Why are we doing it?
Well, for me, it's more a conceptual issue, and maybe one of, if you like, intellectual integrity. If, as I said initially, if you start explaining to some layperson what is the essence of quantum mechanics, then you easily end up still referring to complementarity or uncertainty, and in that context, you wonder quickly how is it with the two? Is it one or the other? So it's a matter for me of coming to terms with that and then cleaning that up once and for all, and then we'd be done with it.
Well, as you said, I already said that the same thing. I would agree with that.
Well, in a certain reading, you can say that, yeah. In a certain reading, there was subtle difference, even in that case. Complementarity there in that reading is the exclusivity of position and momentum measurements. Now, I would still maintain that things have moved on from there through the development of positive operator measures. One has learned to deal or to envisage measurements that have intrinsic quantum imprecisions in them. And if you do those, you can take a position. There are models that this has been done. You can take position measurements which are imprecise, intrinsically imprecise, because your probe is a quantum system. You can take a momentum device, measurement device of the same kind, and you can make them interact with the same object at the same time, and then you can model and follow through the model and see how these two measurement interactions interfere with each other. And what you get is a proper measurement of a phase space, sort of phase space observable, which has an intrinsic unsharpness in it, which is given by the uncertainty relation. And as a matter of fact, we knew this for more than 20 years now that. Yeah, if perhaps more than 50 years, people believed in that, but it's been made precise only some 20, 25 years ago. If you allow for measurement inaccuracy satisfying the Heisenberg uncertainty, then such measurement procedures can be done together without disturbing each other too much. But the price is that you only get imperfect knowledge about the momentum. So we knew all along that the uncertainty relation is sufficient for that. But it's only in the last year or two that mathematically has been shown that the uncertainty relation also is a necessity in all this. So, which I find reassuring as a matter of fact, to be able to make that precise and to get done with it as well. You know that. The one mathematical sheet that I showed you here shows just this for two spin components, that's spin X and spin Y. That's just what this was showing. If and only if you allow for a certain fuzziness in your uncharged observables, will you be able to measure them together? So I think these things are sufficiently clear to lay them down in the textbook and then be done with it. And I only wish people would do it now. Would teach it like that.
Okay, I appreciate that. So that's about you now.